From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, my son the lesbian. That's what Kate Bornstein was sometimes called by her perplexed mother. Kate Bornstein was born male, chose to be surgically transformed into a woman, and now thinks of herself as transgendered, challenging all conceptions of gender. Also today, a less drastic way of altering your identity, changing your name. We'll hear a story from the radio series This American Life. And TV critic David Bianculli looks at Xena's Daughters, the new TV shows about warrior women. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Just a few days before a summit with President Clinton, Russian President Boris Yeltsin is criticizing the U.S. In a television interview, Yeltsin said the U.S. hasn't done much to help Russia since it abandoned communism, and that the relations between the two countries are unequal. Yeltsin said he doesn't want a return to the Cold War, but there must be equal conditions in the world order. A European Union delegation is expected in the Albanian capital, Tirana, today. It's being asked to assess a request for military intervention to restore order in the Balkan country, which has slipped into a state of anarchy. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli reports from Tirana.
President Salih Berisha said today he would ask the EU delegation to send police and economic aid to Albania. In an interview with Europe One Radio, the president said he preferred police to foreign troops because they could work with Albanian police. The vast majority of the Albanian population is demanding that Berisha resign. They blame him for devastating financial losses with the collapse of shady pyramid investment schemes in January. But the president has steadfastly refused to step down. In today's interview, he reiterated a past pledge that he would resign if his Democratic Party loses elections in June. He also said the dreaded secret police, the Sheikh, had been all but disbanded and denied he had given orders for troops to fire on Albanian citizens. The situation appeared calmer in Tirana today, but armed civilians still patrolled the streets. This is Silvia Poggioli in Tirana.
A homemade bomb went off outside a mosque in Paris early today. One person was slightly injured. The explosion blew out the doors and windows of the mosque about an hour before morning prayers. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. This is the fourth day of a strike at the General Motors truck plant in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Jerome Vaughn of member station WDET in Detroit has more.
Members of UAW Local 2209 began the strike Friday over staffing and safety concerns. 2,700 workers are calling for fewer overtime hours and additional hiring at the truck production facility. The major issue for General Motors is staying competitive. University of Michigan auto analyst Dave Cole says GM is working to become more efficient with the workers it already has.
If they cannot match up in the use of their employees to the same level that the Japanese are or Ford or Chrysler, they won't survive.
The Fort Wayne plant produces GM's popular CK pickup trucks. Some analysts say the strike could cost the company as much as $25 million per week. For National Public Radio, this is Jerome Vaughn in Detroit.
On Wall Street this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 48 points at 6886.74 in moderate trading of 202 million shares. The Nasdaq is down 16.47 points at 1276.50. This is National Public Radio News. Wall Street did attempt a rally this morning, but it failed. We hear more from Bloomberg's Doug Christner.
Investors are responding to comments from billionaire investor Warren Buffett, who sounded a bit like Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, cautioning that investors risk paying too much for virtually all stocks. Even so, Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway has tripled its investment in McDonald's. Among the session's losers are the tobacco stocks. The Supreme Court rejected a constitutional challenge to a Florida law that makes it easier for the state to sue cigarette makers to recover Medicaid costs. And shares in Advanticorp have plunged after warning of a surprise loss stemming from larger-than-expected defaults on credit card loans. I'm Doug Krisner.
H.F. Amundsen & Company today upped the ante for Great Western Financial Corporation. It raised its hostile bid to $6.73 billion, topping the friendly offer by Washington Mutual. Whichever deal succeeds will result in the nation's largest savings institution. Rockwell International plans to spin off its automotive parts to shareholders and concentrate on its semiconductor, automation, and aviation businesses. The automotive business has about 16,000 employees and is worth $3.1 billion. It makes things such as sunroofs and seat adjustment systems for cars and light trucks. Rockwell's chairman, David Beal, said the company's convinced that the full potential of these businesses can best be reached by operating separately. Rockwell hopes the spinoff will be completed by the end of September, pending government approval of the deal as a tax-free transaction. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation for reporting on disadvantaged youth and families, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a world of males and females, Kate Bornstein thinks of herself as neither. Bornstein was born male and did his best to become a convincing man, although he never felt convinced. In the mid-1980s, when he was 38 years old, he had surgery to physically alter his gender to female. But he soon realized that the surgery didn't completely transform him into a woman. So now Kate Bornstein thinks of herself as transgendered. Her memoir, Gender Outlaw, is about the nature of gender, sex, and identity. Her new novel, co-authored with Caitlin Sullivan, is about gender-bending erotic adventures in cyberspace, where you don't need a surgeon to change your gender. I asked Kate Bornstein what it was like, after surgery, to wake up thinking she was now a woman.
Oh, the waking up was fabulous. No, don't get me wrong. I woke up in the hospital room, and I went, oh, my gosh, because I had, like, when I was a little kid, I had prayed every night, please, God, let me wake up and be a girl, I mean, at that age. And then I woke up out of the anesthesia, and, wow, for all intents and purposes, I had done it. Of course, living the next year or so proved me that I hadn't, but for that moment, it was wonderful.
So what was the turning point for you when, instead of starting to think about yourself as a man or as a woman, you started to think of yourself as transgendered?
Well, I was hanging out with a bunch of lesbian feminists, for the most part. That's where I was, back in Philadelphia. And they were asking me some pretty intelligent questions, like, how can you be a woman if you don't have the history that many women in this culture have? How can you be a woman if you can't give birth? Although we know some women who can't. We want to know how. And they weren't being antagonistic. They were genuinely curious. And I love that when someone's genuinely curious, and it made me think. And I thought, well, if you take those factors into account, then I guess I'm not. And that just pulled the rug right from underneath me. Because I knew I wasn't a guy. I still don't feel like a guy. And I know I'm not a woman.
So before you arrived at this new identity of yourself as like none of the above,
yeah,
did you go into this like incredible depression thinking, well, then what am I?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, I mean, what are we allowed to be? We're allowed to be boys or girls. We're allowed to be men or women. I grew up thinking, wow, this is it. You know, I'm a man for all intents and purposes. And when I heard about this possibility of what was being called a sex change, I thought, oh my gosh, that's it. I am really a woman. That must be it. And to be faced with the prospect of being neither in a culture that says you've got to be one or the other. Yeah, I was depressed. I was horribly depressed. Now it's a hoot.
You've come to think of gender as a social construct. In other words, that gender is really a combination of learned behaviors and attitudes and beliefs. So if you had thought that before your surgery, do you think you still would have had surgery?
That's like such a great question. I have no idea. I think I would have waited longer before actually deciding, because I went into it, Terry, believing that gender was biology and that biology was destiny, this whole thing. I believed it was all genitalia, and that once my genitalia were modified to look sort of like a woman's genitalia, then everything would be fine. But it's not even genitalia is what I found out, and that's what the hoot is. I mean, there's so many different kinds of genitals. There's so many different kinds of hormones or chromosome combinations. It's impossible to bottom line what's a man and what's a woman.
What have you come to think of as the differences between men and women besides their anatomical construction?
I could get smart and sassy, but I think what it really boils down to is a power differential within any given culture. And I think that's what it boils down to. I could be cute and I could say, oh, well, you know, women... No, I can't be cute about it. There's nothing cute about gender at this point in our culture. I think it's a game that's being played out to keep half of the world's population oppressed.
So you don't think there are any real differences between men and women except for what we kind of socialize them into being?
Well, I think there are biological differences of people born with penises and people born with vaginas and vulvas and that equipment. I think, sure, there's height differential, sometimes there's weight differential, sometimes there's muscular differential. But what other kind of differences are we looking for? Are we saying that the difference is temperament and that can be controlled hormonally? I don't think so. I don't think there's that much of a difference. I think we'd probably find that we're a lot more similar if we were given the opportunity to explore what's called masculine or feminine behavior.
How much was your desire to change gender a function of sexuality, of wanting to sexually function as a woman?
Actually, very little, because I went into this whole gender change, Terry, with the whole idea that I wasn't going to be sexually active at all. I figured, who would want me? I was interested mostly in women. I had always been interested in women in my all my life, romantically. I'd had a few sexual encounters with men, which I enjoyed, but my romantic interest was always women. So I didn't do this so that I could be sexually active with a man. In fact, my surgeon told me that, well, golly, there's a lot of tissue deterioration here, because what they do is they invert your penis to form the vaginal cavity. And they said there was a lot of deterioration from the hormones I'd been taking and that it wasn't going to be very deep. And I said, well, you know, I'm a lesbian, so I don't need that kind of depth. And he looked at me and goes, oh, right, okay. He was a very cool doctor.
It certainly makes all categories very confusing when someone is in your shoes.
And it's also hard to buy shoes my size.
I'm sure that's true. What are some of the things you learned to do differently when you started living as a woman?
Wow. Well, the working thing, I think, was probably the biggest thing I had to learn. I was working at an IBM subsidiary at the time, and I was doing sales. And selling as a guy, first you had to get past the secretary or the receptionist and get yourself into the decision maker. And that meant either flirting or somehow doing the guy-girl thing. And then once you got to the decision maker, then it was, okay, let's talk here. The decision maker usually being a guy, in the time when I was doing it, you talk to this decision maker and you say, okay, let's talk some turkey here. Let's see what you need. And I tried that as a woman, Terry, and it didn't fly at all. People were like, they were calling me a castrating bitch, and I wasn't doing anything different at all until I changed the style of my selling. And instead of saying, well, let's talk turkey here, I'd say, well, gosh, what do you think? I mean, we've laid out your needs, and you probably know better than I do, and it looks like this would be right for you. What do you think? And I went, oh, I get it. They have to be powerful. They have to be right. And that kind of dynamic is what I found plays itself out on pretty much every level of my daily life these days. I found out a whole lot about that stuff.
Do you think you walk differently or talk differently as a woman than you did as a man?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I was, you know, I did phone sex for a couple of years to pay the bills. And
To pay your surgery bills?
No.
Or just to pay bills in general?
Just to pay bills in general, the rent. And, you know, I was doing theater at the time, and that didn't pay anything. Still doesn't. But I did phone sex, and I was doing pretty well at it. And guys would get on the line and they'd say, you know, hey, Stormy, you've got a voice like an angel. You were born to do phone sex. And I'd think to myself, you know, not really. but, you know, because I wasn't born with this voice, Terry. You know, I was born with this voice. You know, I had this kind of a deep voice of a guy, right?
Well, no, but you're faking that voice. Give me your real guy voice.
My real guy voice was probably down around here. I would think. And I'm trying to like unlearn all this stuff. I went to a voice teacher and she went through this whole thing of raising my pitch. They wanted me to talk way up here, Terry, and then add breathiness and modulation and tag questions, you know what I mean? And I thought, I don't want to talk like that. So I taught myself how to talk by listening to Laurie Anderson records.
So you have what would be considered a high voice for a man and a deep voice for a woman.
Bingo.
No, in that little demonstration of what the speech teacher was telling you, there was also a put a smile in your voice. I'm wondering if people expect you to smile more as a woman than they did as a man. I've noticed like with photographers are more likely to ask a woman to smile than a man.
People stop me on the street and say, honey, smile. I'm going, excuse me? Please. No, I don't smile as much as a woman who was born a woman and is my age, was socialized to smile. I don't do that. No. Unfortunately, yeah. I hang out mostly in the lesbian community. And within the lesbian community, that kind of woman socialization is not exactly encouraged.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kate Bornstein. She's the author of the memoir Gender Outlaw and co-author of the new novel Nearly Roadkill, which is about gender and transgendered identities on the internet. And Kate has had a sex change operation, male to female, but now considers herself to be transgendered, neither exactly male nor female. And she's kind of challenging the whole idea of gender-specific traits. Let's take a short break. And then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Kate Bornstein, her memoir, Gender Outlaw, is her account of growing up male, getting surgically transformed to female, and ending up feeling transgendered. I know when I'm walking down a street, especially a dark street at night, I wish that I could look really imposing, which is kind of hard for me to do at my height. But you're what?
How tall are you?
I'm a little over 5 feet, whereas you are over 6 feet.
Just under 6 feet, yeah.
Just under 6 feet, yeah. So, I mean, you could do the imposing thing probably a lot more easily. Do you try to use kind of guy approaches to walking down the street on dark, lonely streets?
Yeah, and I was actually mugged about 4 years ago. It was in Philadelphia, right outside the train station. I was going down one of those stairs that are on the street down into the subway system.
Mm-hmm.
And I came around the corner, and this guy was all of a sudden holding a knife in my belly. And I went, oh, my gosh. And I was having a bad day anyway. And so my height, my appearance, nothing was stopping this guy. And I figured, I've got a meeting I've got to get to. I just bellowed at him in my guy voice. I said, get the F out of my face. And he jumped. He jumped like 14 steps up the stairs. And he started looking at me and went, faggot, faggot, faggot. And I went, God blessed right, you get out of here. And I didn't care what he thought I was. I just wanted him gone. So I've got that advantage, yeah.
Not the time to stop the mugger and say, no, really, I'm transgendered.
Yes.
Let me explain the concept.
Can't you hear? No, I'm really am a woman. And you're right. Here, take all my money. Oh, dear. What is this? Oh, man.
Well, I think one of the things you really have going for you in this situation is that you come from theater. You've always been in theater. I mean, since I think high school.
Yeah.
So this sense of display and that an aspect of life always is theater, is just a kind of part of your, that's in your blood. So it's probably easier for you and even pleasing for you to use that kind of public display and confusion in a way that connects with your sense of identity.
I like it, and that's a good point. And it's like what you were saying just a few minutes ago about how you walk down the street and try to like give this impression that you're untouchable, people shouldn't come near you. You probably walk faster and you look ahead. But doing that kind of display, theater as display, does not work on a day-to-day level. It doesn't work in relationships. I had to get rid of, I had to name for myself what I didn't like about myself that I considered male or man, and literally get rid of it. One I'd already mentioned was this whole idea of assuming I belong, this whole idea, this attitude of I deserve all of this, which is what many, many, many males are raised with, especially in this culture, is I deserve, you deserve. I was raised believing I could be president of the United States, Terry. How many girls are raised with that? I don't think so. So that does color things.
Kate, what kind of man were you before you had your sex change operation?
It depends on what time of my life you are asking. I think in grade school and high school, I was just a scared kid. In college, I started to get the idea that people would really believe whatever I put out there. And I remember I had this part in a show where I had to play this macho guy, and it was maybe in my sophomore year of college. And I learned how to do this macho walk, this kind of, hey, I'm bad kind of thing. And people believed that's who I was. For a long time, people believed I was very, very macho, and I kept that up. I think, though, I was basically your nice Jewish boy. You know, you're kind of a little bit nebbishy, a little bit geeky, a little bit nerdy kind of guy.
Now, you reprint in your memoir a yearbook photo of you in which you're sporting quite a big mustache. And I'm wondering what the mustache phase of your life was like. Why you, of all people, had a mustache?
Oh, God, that was to keep me from dressing. I was dressing compulsively. I mean, that's part of it. You know, like when you really don't take a look at gender, you think it's all in clothing. And, or at least I did. And I would dress at every opportunity, dress as a woman. And once I had the mustache, couldn't really do that very well and pass anyway. So I kept the mustache, sometimes a beard. I also kept on a lot of weight. I was up to 240 pounds at one point, just so that I didn't have to deal with this stuff. So I could say, okay, I look in the mirror, I see a guy, that's all I want to see. I don't want to pay attention. I put my whole life on hold.
And when did you shave it?
Actually, after I the most embarrassing thing in my life is that I used to be a member of a group called Scientology, and it was after I got out of Scientology that I actually shaved the mustache and started exploring this gender stuff for real.
How do you explain the Scientology part of your life? I ask you that because you're obviously embarrassed about it.
I think, you know, I was at a vulnerable point coming out of college. The next step, I was an actor, and the next step was for me to go to New York and seek my fortune in New York as an actor, and that scared me so much that I decided to take a trip across country, and I ran into Scientology, and they were promising the sun, moon, and stars, and they also had like sections of their work where they came down real hard on gays, lesbians, and perversions, as they called it, and I figured, well, geez, you know, these people have got me pegged. That must be the group to belong to. So I did. And I considered my time in Scientology as amends for being such a twisted, evil, disgusting person.
Did it help you at all?
Oh, sure, I guess. I mean, I think I spent a little too much time there, Terry. It was about 11 years. So I don't think I got 11 years worth of goodie out of it. But there weren't all evil people in that group.
Kate, maybe you can help me with this. I'm always curious about this. It often seems that transsexuals and transvestites are more into being a female, you know, like, quote, feminine kind of woman than most women I know are. Do you know what I mean? Like, most women I know, they wear, you know, jeans and slacks, and to get dressed up, wear really nice slacks and, you know, flat shoes. I mean, I've never worn high heels outside of like junior high when I'd get dressed up or something.
Yeah.
And I mean, yet like men who consider themselves to be feminine just put on, you know, real heavy drag. You know, I don't know if you wear heels or stuff like that, but you know, heels and dresses and fashion, and it's like they're trying to be a woman that most of the women I know don't or have never even tried to be.
I agree. And I went through that phase myself. I think if you're forbidden from dressing some way, and you see these television shows and these ads that show if you dress this way with high heels and a flowing skirt and you flip to your hair like Marcia Brady, then you're adored, you get taken to the prom, you get bought flowers. This is the myth that goes on. And if you're a man going toward being a woman, then you were responsible for helping to generate that myth. So you've got, you know, a stake in it. And it takes you a while to learn that, oh, wait a minute, these heels are killing me. I hate them. I don't want to spend, 20 minutes to a half hour putting makeup on every morning. I don't care. I'm going to cut my hair short so I don't have to fuss with it. You learn that stuff as you go on. But I think at first, no, you go overboard. And the same way going the other way, female to male, transsexuals and transvestites and transgendered people, by and large, go a little bit too far. They get really macho at first, and then you kind of settle down into a good expression of yourself.
So do you consider clothing now to be an important statement about identity, and how do you dress?
I dress fabulously, Terry. I am having such a good time. I have been like politically active for 10 years, and I've been kind of politically correct about all this stuff and kind of going, all right, well, I will be very conservative here. But nah. You know who my role model is now?
Not me.
No. Well, it's like Gina Davis in The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's great. Oh, it's great. She does this whole thing where she plays her own kind of evil twin, only it's not an evil twin. And I like that evil side of her. And so I'm kind of doing that kind of thing, Emma Peel-ish kind of a thing.
So what clothes does that require?
Oh, lots of black, very gothic. Sometimes heels, but mostly boots. I like fingerless gloves. I like fishnet tops. And sometimes I just wear, like a t-shirt and jeans. But mostly black.
Well, Marquis de Sade look.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I played the Marquis de Sade in college.
Did you really?
Yes, I did. I also played Mac the Knife. I had a lot of fun acting.
Kate Bornstein is the author of the memoir Gender Outlaw and co-author of the new novel Nearly Roadkill. She'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with self-described gender outlaw Kate Bornstein. Also, changing her identity by changing your name. And David Bianculli looks at TV's new Warrior Women. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Kate Bornstein. Her memoir, Gender Outlaw, is her account of growing up male, surgically transforming herself to female, only to figure out she wasn't exactly that either. Transgendered is the word she now prefers. Bornstein also co-authored the new novel, Nearly Roadkill, about gender-bending and erotic adventures on the Internet. Kate, when you told your mother, which I assume that you did, that you were getting a male-to-female sex change operation, what did she tell you? What did she say?
Her first response is, she said, "Why are you telling me this? Why don't you let me go to my grave, believing I have a son?" And I explained to her, I said, "Well, if I didn't tell you now, then I'd never be able to see or speak with you again." And her first response was, "If you go through with this, if you really go through with this, then don't bother coming back here because you're not welcome in this house." And I guess it was for about maybe 5 or 6 months we were on really tense terms with each other. And it wasn't until I called her and told her what a rough time people were giving me at work that she got it, and she started calling me Kate. I guess this whole mother-child thing is just a lot more important than something as silly as gender.
Did she ever tell her friends about you?
She told some of her friends, but she lived in a very small town down the Jersey Shore, and some people would have been unkind to her and cruel to her, and she had no way of judging who would be what. So she'd only told a very tight group of her friends, which meant that every time I went back to visit her, some people would wonder, who is this tall woman coming to visit you from time to time?
So some people thought that she had a son, and some people thought she had a daughter?
Most everybody on the shore, because again, it was a small town, knew that she had me as a son and my brother. They knew she had two sons. So there would be times when I would be out to dinner and we'd meet a friend of hers and they'd say, "Oh, Mildred," they'd say to her, "Look, you know, this is so nice to see you. Where's your son, Albert? I haven't seen him." And they would be asking this right in front of me. And she would say, "Oh, Albert's on the West Coast." And I'd be sitting right there.
And were you understanding or angry?
Oh, you know how kids get. At first I was angry. At first, no, I was insistent that she use the quote-unquote right pronoun because, you know, I was being a woman and I wanted her to say she and her and Kate and all that. And after a while, we both kind of would laugh about it. She would call me Albert or he, or, and it really didn't matter. It really didn't matter.
You had a nice piece in the New York Times Magazine in the hers column about what it was like at your mother's funeral when you ran into some of her friends who couldn't figure out who you were. Had you planned on how to handle it before you went?
Oh, goodness, no. The only thing I planned, I mean, I knew my mom. My mom had breast cancer, and we knew she was dying. And I was living on the West Coast at the time. She was still in New Jersey. So every time I would come to visit her, I would pack this black dress just in case. And sure enough, this one time I was there, she passed. It was pretty bad. I was really, really upset. We'd gotten to be such good friends. At the funeral service, I was standing there by the coffin crying and crying, and these women would come up to me, and there were little old ladies with blue hair and kind of rhinestone cat glasses, and they'd look up and go, "Who are you?" I go, I'm Kate Bornstein. I'm Mildred's daughter." I'd have to think what to say. You know, I have to think, you know, what can I tell these people? And they'd look at me and they go, "Daughter? Daughter? Mildred never mentioned she had a daughter before. Who's your father? It's not Paul, am I right?" And, you know, and then I could just hear the gossip going on. You know, "Mildred has a daughter, did you see? And Albert never even came to the funeral." Oh, God.
Oh, how strange.
Yeah. And then people would, like, call me by the wrong name at the funeral, and I couldn't get upset by that. I was so upset by my mother. And they would get upset. They would get doubly upset. And I go, don't worry, it's okay.
What kind of woman was your mother? I mean, gender-wise, was she what you'd call, you know, feminine or what?
Barbara Stanwyck.
Uh-huh.
You know, she was strong. She was like really, really strong woman. She was definitely feminine, if you want to call it that. She considered herself a lady and most people who knew her considered her a lady.
Did she give you any advice on how to be a woman?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Don't come downstairs without your makeup. Don't come downstairs in a bathrobe. And never trust another woman.
Yeah. That's very retro advice, don't you think?
My mom was very retro. She was born at a time and in a culture where all of her value as a woman was based on the men in her life. Uh-huh. Her father was a successful merchant. Her husband was a successful doctor. She gave birth to two sons. Within a Jewish setting and in the time, you know, like the early 1900s and the mid-1900s, when she was living, this was very important. And so when her father died, her husband died, and one of her sons became a lesbian, this kind of shook her world, you know? This kind of shook her world up a bit. And God bless her. She, you know, took her about a year, and then she finally said, well, there's nothing I can do about it. I might as well find out who you are. And we started talking. We started from square zero.
Well, I'm glad that you ended up having such a good relationship.
Yeah, it was important.
Well, I want to ask you about your new novel that you've co-authored. It's called Nearly Roadkill, and the novel takes place on the Internet. And the point of the novel is that the Internet is a place where you could be any gender you want to. No one will be the wiser. What's the difference between how men and women relate on the Internet?
I don't know, because I don't know whether I've met the women I've met or the men I've met were really men or women, so I don't pay attention to that anymore. I don't know. And I think what's fun is when you can find someone to play with, if you can agree to say, okay, let's be a pair of gay guys today. Let's go on the net and be a pair of gay men and see what trouble we can get into. Or the next day, let's go online and be left-handed Lithuanians. Or let's be circus performers. Let's tell everybody we're in the circus.
Do you suspect that there's a lot of macho men or, you know, confident feminine females who, once they get online, like, change gender and have a good time and don't tell anybody?
Absolutely. I've talked with quite a few of them. And it's fun. It's fun because you can encourage that. I've talked with macho guys, and I've said, because, look, when I did Phone Sex, the biggest fantasy, Terry, was, well, what's it like to be a lesbian? You know, and what do lesbians do? And can I be a lesbian with you? That most of the guys that would call wanted to have lesbian sex with a lesbian. And so that's what they do online. I mean, trying to find a lesbian online is difficult. You usually find a guy.
Let's talk about phone sex a little bit. What were the common fantasies that you found?
Guys wanted to be dominated, and guys wanted to be turned into women, and guys wanted to have sex as a woman with a woman. Those were the common ones.
Have you thought about why?
I think it gets back to, again, the pressure that's on guys to be stuck in this one rigid identity, this masculine, macho kind of identity. Even where macho isn't part of it, there's still a rigidity that goes with the concept of man that women don't have. And I think guys need a break. And why not? Go ahead, be, you know, like, they think the only break is being a woman, and they think they have to pretend and hide, and then they feel guilty. But why not just go on and say, I'm not going to tell you what my gender is, but I am being a woman right now. If you can deal with that, then let's talk.
Do you think that some of the people who had these fantasies when having phone sex would leave the phone and then, like, rigidly uphold gender stereotypes of what men and women are supposed to be?
Absolutely. I had this one regular client who was, if you believed him, he was a high-powered executive, and he would tell me about all of his marketing deals, and we would talk about marketing for the most part, and then he had this, like, one fantasy where he would always want to have sex with me on top of laundry equipment. He thought that was really sexy. But for the most part, we would talk about, you know, marketing ideas. And then he would go back to his work. He would always call from his office.
Do you find that laundry equipment thing kind of mysterious?
Oh, gosh. There's stuff I can't say on the air, but yeah, I got to a point doing the phone sex and listening to people's fantasies. I was able to be a lot more compassionate, not only with them, but with myself. And I thought, well, golly, you know, I don't have this laundry equipment thing going with my sex thing, so I can be a little understanding about that.
I wonder if you ever envy people who don't really give much of a thought to their gender. They just are what they are. It's not an issue one way or another.
It's a double-edged sword. I deeply envy people who don't think about it. I personally have never gone to bed a night in my life knowing what gender I am. Not one night, Terry. And I wonder, am I that screwed up? I guess. And then part of me thinks, well, I'm intelligent. Maybe I'm onto something here. Maybe people should be thinking about gender. Is gender something that's, especially the bipolar gender system where there's two and two only, is that something that's so insidious that it's got a lot of people fooled? I don't know. I feel like the kid who pointed at the emperor and said, hey, he's not wearing any clothes.
Is there anything that you would really like someday to experience that's associated with manhood or womanhood that you feel you haven't experienced yet?
You know what, Terry? I don't think so. I really don't think so. And I think I've done it. I like the... All right, okay, here we go. I want to continue my acting. I would like to one day just play a normal old role on stage that didn't have anything to do with gender or, oh, look at the freak, or that would be nice. That would be really nice. Just to play a 50-year-old woman on stage, that would be great.
Well, Kate Bornstein, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Wow, thank you.
Kate Bornstein is the author of the memoir Gender Outlaw and co-author of the new novel Nearly Roadkill. Coming up, changing your identity by changing your name. This is Fresh Air. Here's another story about self-identity and how it can be changed. From time to time, we feature excerpts from This American Life, a national weekly radio program from WBEZ in Chicago. This story is from a recent edition about changing your name. Here's the host of This American Life, Ira Glass.
When my grandmother, Molly Politzer, was just 32 years old, she got sick. So sick that she was in the hospital for months. So sick that the doctors thought she would die. So sick that finally, when all seemed to fail, they called for a rabbi, and he changed her name. As my mom explains,
the reason the rabbi said that they changed her name was so that when the angel of death came, that he wouldn't, you know who she was, and he would, you know, wouldn't take her.
It's such a beautiful picture of what the angel of death is, that the angel of death could be so easily fooled.
Mm-hmm.
The angel of death is stupid.
Well,
Angel of Death is like the UPS man. Well, it says here the address. I've got
right,
the name.
Right.
Are you sure she's not here?
Well, it's sort of like if they put the wrong name tag on you in the hospital, then you get the wrong operation.
So my grandmother changed her name to fool the angel of death. And it worked. She survived, got well, changed her name back to what it was, lived to the age of 87. There's something so medieval about this story. So unlike my family, actually, my family, which basically discarded the old world, you know, the day that they got off the boat. But I think it's easy to believe that there's something magical when you change your name, you know? You change your name, you become a new person. You take on a different identity. You start over again, clean slate. You know, in a way, it's a very American impulse. It's the new world. It's the move westward. It's divorce and self-help and 12-step programs and Ellis Island all rolled into one. It's the story of Marilyn Monroe and Andy Warhol, Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X, and the artist formerly known as Prince. In Los Angeles, to legally change your name, you show up at the L.A. Civil Courthouse at 5 minutes before 9, Thursday or Friday, and go to room 208, Department 1A. It works like this. You file a petition to change your name that costs $189. You pay about $85 to publish your name change in the newspaper. If you're changing your kid's name, you need to prove that it's okay with the other parent, or prove that you have searched for the other parent and you cannot find them. And you have to fill out a form, so they can check and make sure that you're not a registered sex offender.
Imagine a line at the Department of Motor Vehicles. That's what this line looks like. Several teenage girls in white or black jeans, long nylon coats, heavy makeup, and long, long crimped hair. A few couples stand, holding hands, and look to each other for assurance.
We sent writer Margie Rockland to watch the proceedings last Friday. 17 people showed up. There was a youngish black guy with an afro, baggy plaid pants, and a battered briefcase, changing his name from Damon Washington to Damoni Ide Sativa. A Vietnamese man named Sunny Tay Ang changed his name to Sunny Thomas Wu. A school teacher named Carol Ann Anderson became Deva Kaur Anderson. Her yoga teacher gave her the name. It means angel princess. But more than half the people who come here are mothers who want to change their children's names. Apparently they don't want to be reminded of the ex who isn't around. We asked Margie Rockland to describe the scene, what she saw when she visited.
Even without being told, people follow the rules of any legal proceeding. If they speak, they speak softly. For 15 minutes, I sit in this room watching a line of people, one after the other, speak to the court clerk, a young woman who looks a lot like Kim Goldman, Ron Goldman's little sister from the O.J. Simpson trial. Mostly, the court clerk asks and answers questions. She examines their papers and says things like, "Are you his mother?" The minutes tick by, and each of the people are addressed in the same kind, helpful tones, and then they walk out the door. And then at a certain point, I realize something. This is it. There's no more to this proceeding. In my mind, I'd imagine that the filing of the papers was going to be followed by some kind of swearing-in process, like the kind that happens when you become an American citizen. I pictured a group of people standing up with their right hand raised and a judge banging the gavel and then making them repeat some official oath, although I'm not sure what that could be. I, new name goes here, solemnly swear that I will answer to my new name and no other, so help me God. Where the judge sits, there's only an empty chair and a nameplate that says Murray Gross, Commissioner. Later, I ask the clerk why the judge isn't around, and she says, "Oh, he is. He's been here all day long. He's in the back." And then she waves her hand in the direction of a room behind her. The thing is, I look through the open door, and I only see a secretary wandering around. And immediately, I think of the great and powerful Oz. There's no Murray Gross, I think. In Los Angeles, if you want to get your name changed, you deal with this clerk. Her name is Robin. She's a temp.
About five deep into the line, there's a tall, thin, elderly woman with a fuzz of gray hair who stands as patiently as the rest. She wears all white. A long white sweater, white sheer stockings, white shoes, and an ankle-length, crisply ironed, pleated white skirt. There is something about her that immediately catches your eye. She's the only one in line wearing a crown, a beaded one, gold and blue. This is Her Holiness O'Brien. Her name used to be Olivia, she tells me, but in 1981, God told her to change her name. She wouldn't say why. To Her Holiness, and she respectfully complied. Ever since then, everyone at the retirement home where she lives calls her Her Holiness, or nothing at all. What do they call you for short? I ask her, and she smiles dreamily at me. That's it, no answer. Her Holiness has definitely dealt with bigger smart alecks than myself. Somewhere from the folds of her all-white costume, she pulls out a small black leather wallet, and she shows me her Social Security card and her driver's license, and they both say, Her Holiness O'Brien. Then she slides the cards back into the wallet, adjusts her crown with a tiny tap of her long, skinny fingers, and then she disappears off down the court hallway. Watching this whole thing, it's hard to believe how simple it is to change something that has been so much a part of your life for so long. Something that seems irrevocable. This thing you've had since birth. And when they walk out of the courtroom, people have an expression that I've only seen in one other place. It's the "what just happened" expression of newlyweds after they've been married in a quickie wedding in Las Vegas. So much anticipation has come before this. So much thought has been invested on the road to this moment. And it all happens so quickly, they don't know what to feel. They assume they're going to feel different, but they don't feel different, just numb. Sometimes they actually say it out loud to Robin. They lean towards her and whisper, "Is that it?" "That's it," she says, moving on to the next applicant.
Margie Rocklin is a contributor to This American Life. The program is hosted and produced by Ira Glass. Coming up, the Daughters of Xena, warrior women of television. This is Fresh Air. In the last 2 weeks, ABC has unveiled a new spy series, MTV has presented a new cartoon series, and the WB Network has launched a new action series. TV critic David Bianculli says all three shows have two things in common, and one of them is Xena.
If you still haven't seen the syndicated action series Xena Warrior Princess, you may not know what kind of sea change TV is going through right now. But ever since Xena was spun off from Hercules and put in her own series, she's not only been beating up everybody on her show has been beating other shows, too. Xena Warrior Princess has risen through the ranks in a very short time to become the most popular action hour in syndication. In other words, what Rosie O'Donnell has done with the talk show, Lucy Lawless, as Xena, has done to the action show. And while TV programmers have been quick to churn out inferior medieval knockoffs, a really bad Sinbad in syndication, an even worse Robin Hood on TNT, they've also been quick to realize that new shows with strong women at their center can not only survive, but thrive. So all of a sudden, there are all these new shows with independent women at their centers. That's one thing they have in common, the Xena factor. The other thing is, They're all fun to watch. First up is WB's Buffy the Vampire Slayer, a new TV version of the 1992 movie. The film starred Christy Swanson, who played Buffy as a vacuous valley girl. In the TV version, Sarah Michelle Gellar plays her as much more intelligent and much more cocky, even when she appears outnumbered, trying to rescue friends from some badly dressed teen vampires.
Okay, first of all, what's with the outfit? Live in the now, okay? You look like DeBarge. Now, we can do this the hard way, or, well, actually, there's just the hard way.
That's fine with me.
Are you sure? Now, this is not gonna be pretty. We're talking violence, strong language, adult content.
Another new series with a strong heroine is MTV's Daria. And this one, too, is about a high school girl who moves to a new town. But Daria is a cartoon character, and the town she came from had two citizens in it named Beavis and Butthead. So this might not be a show where you'd expect too much intelligence, but you'd be wrong. Daria is kind of like an animated version of my so-called life. Listen to a typical family dinner conversation at Daria's house.
What about you, Daria? How was your first day?
Well, my history teacher hates me because I know the answers. But there are some interesting idiots in my class.
That's great!
Jake!
I mean...
Daria, your father's trying to tell you not to judge people until you know them. You're in a brand new school in a brand new town. You don't want it to be Highland all over again.
Not much chance of that happening. Unless there's uranium in the drinking water here, too.
Finally, there's Spy Game on ABC. I don't need to play a clip here. I just need to point out that Allison Smith plays a super spy who's the toughest female secret agent since the glory days of Emma Peel on The Avengers. On TV, where helpless women in jeopardy is an official genre, this is a very welcome trend.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Fred Snyder, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.